What if, before enacting massive new programs, the federal government conducted a few experiments to see what worked? From what if to why not? Today on Uncommon Knowledge, science and technology expert Jim Manzi on his new book, Uncontrolled. And a few moments after my conversation with Jim, Jonah Goldberg, from an earlier interview we recorded, on his new book, The Tyranny of Clichés. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Be sure to visit us on our website at hoover.org/UK or on our Facebook page at facebook.com/UNCKnowledge, facebook.com/UNCKknowledge. Later in the program, a few minutes of Jonah Goldberg on his new book, The Tyranny of Clichés. Now, however, Jim Manzi. The founder and chairman of Applied Predictive Technologies, Jim Manzi is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor at National Review. His new book, Uncontrolled, The Surprising Payoff of Trial and Error for Business, Politics, and Society. Jim Manzi, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Segment one, the argument. From Uncontrolled, science does not proceed as a disembodied logical process. It is an activity conducted by human beings. We don't think science. We do science. All right. What you have in front of you is somebody whose last science course took place in high school. But the moment I completed the last requirement of the New York State Board of Regents, I quit. So be patient with me, Jim. Explain yourself. We don't think science. We do it.
Well, you know, it's funny because in physics, there's an expression that's often credited Einstein, which no one really thinks he said, but is used all the time. And the saying is, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough.
So what a relief. You and I will get along just fine.
Right. So whenever someone says, boy, that sounds so complicated, you must be really clever, my reaction is you haven't thought it through well enough. So okay. I did my best in the book not to use jargon or to demand technical knowledge in any way. And when I talked about doing science rather than thinking science, what the point I was trying to make as I went into a lot of detail about how in my experience science works is that science is very philosophically sloppy. In fact, one of the early points I make in the book is abandoning the attempt to find philosophical truth and merely focusing on ultimately practically useful knowledge, which was the huge insight Francis Bacon had. Is one of the things that created an unlock that allowed science to suddenly start making progress.
Decouples science from theology, so to
speak. Exactly, right? And precisely, not even so to speak, quite precisely.
Got it.
In fact, abandoning the Aristotelian attempt to understand ultimate or final causes and so on and simply focus on, as Bacon put it, thinking, changing our emphasis from where from to whereby. That is looking simply at the world as a collection of particles with rules for their interaction. That enables us to make practical progress. And therefore, science makes all kinds of assumptions, some of which it's aware of and some of which it's not consciously aware of, and most scientists aren't consciously aware of, in order to make progress. And the mat between those assumptions and the world starts to break down as we start to think about more and more complicated environments. So physics addresses phenomena which are less complicated than biology addresses. Biology addresses phenomena that are less complicated than sociology addresses. And many of the kind of rules of thumb, many often the implicit rules of thumb that science follows as a methodology work well in a more simple environment or studying more simple phenomena.
Billiard balls on the pool table. We can all understand Newtonian physics as cause, force and reaction, right?
Right.
Okay.
And so a lot of these almost sociological assumptions that scientists make in the way they do science start to create more and more problems as you apply science to more and more complicated environments.
And when you move from physics to social society, when you go from billiard balls to human beings, the complexity increases vastly. And yet, it's the contention of your book that applying—I'm at the end of this long question. There will be a question. There's a question mark coming for you here, Jim. So it's the contention of this book, however, that we should take scientific methods much more seriously in choosing policies. We should be doing more experiments. We should be applying the lessons of science, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so again, from Uncontrolled, another quotation. I have about three quotations here that I take to be, for the purposes of television, a pretty good way of getting into your basic argument. And here's the second one. Quote, "The randomized field trial is an enormous accomplishment developed through centuries of effort. It has pushed into new areas the frontier of questions that can be addressed through the scientific method," close quote. Now, you know, when you talk about randomized field trial, I picture little white mice. Right. But so just tell me what you mean. Just give me a couple of definitional aids here. Randomized field trial means what? And then explain to me why it's such a breakthrough.
Well, a randomized field trial is the attempt to test some program or intervention by taking a large group of people and randomly choosing some of these people and applying the treatment or the program to them, a literacy program or a program to use counseling to improve school behavior, et cetera, applying that treatment to a random group of people and not applying it to a random control group of people, and then looking at what difference in outcome occurs in the treatment group versus the control group.
Okay, so when Boris Yeltsin said after the fall of the Soviet Union, he was making a joke, but what he said was communism should have been tried in a very small country first.
Right.
He was on to something.
Yes. Unless you live in North Korea, in which case you would be
right. Even
about
even
it.
Okay. All right. So in a moment then, we'll get to how you would make use of science when it comes to questions of public policy. But first, you know, Tom Sowell has sat in that seat. And Tom has said it's one of his just fundamental insights. Actually, it's a fundamental complaint about the way the world works, that in the federal government, nothing ever gets judged except by intentions. Nobody ever stops to say, has that program worked? Now, with you seated across from me, it seems such an obvious question to ask that I almost want to flip the whole order of the program and begin by saying, why don't we do this already?
Right. Well, I think there are several reasons, and I try and get into this in the book in some detail. I think one reason is that there's resistance on the part of political authorities, because as much as people say they want to be measured and held accountable, most people don't. And the sponsors of programs typically don't want to do this. They don't really want measurements of programs. And there are ways to put in place processes that help to overcome that challenge, but we're never going to eliminate the problem of politics. There will always be resistance to measurement, accountability, and control. What I argue in the book is I think we can get a little bit better at it. We can do somewhat more of it, and on the margin, help improve the way we govern better.
Okay, so the problem of politics, I want to just frame that one up sharply because I have the feeling we'll come back to it. The contractor in this is on my mind because I was reading about Harry Truman. So he worked, got caught up in the political machine run by Tom Prendergast. And Tom Prendergast didn't want to build roads efficiently.
Right.
He wanted the contract money to pay off his people.
Right.
That's the political problem. The politicians say they're doing something when in fact they're doing something else.
Yes.
Okay, we'll come back to that. Now, I want viewers to understand that this book is divided into three parts. And the last part, on which we'll spend most of our time today, is the least part in the book.
Right.
And it is the part where you present specific proposals. So I just want viewers to understand more than two-thirds of the book develops your ideas. But this is television.
Great.
So from what if to why not? Let's go through a number of your specific proposals, Jim. And I'll quote from Uncontrolled. Quote, "Institutionalize policy waivers. States should be permitted to change almost any aspect of federally mandated laws and policies on a trial basis, anything from school eligibility rules to medical reimbursement schedules to drug use penalties, as long as they operate in the same kind of structured experimentation program that was operated during the welfare reform period of the 1990s, close quote. First of all, give us structured experimentation period that operated during the 1990s. Explain, give us a little bit of history on that.
Sure. I was referencing a section in the book where I described it. And what was originally a program in the New Deal to aid mothers and widows with children, became by the 1960s and 1980s what became known as AFDC, or Aid to Families with Dependent Children, right, which became a gigantic political issue as it began to be applied to multi-generational families who had never worked, et cetera. And this became one of the central political debates in domestic policy in the United States.
Right.
There was an attempt to reform it beginning in the 1980s into the early 1990s. And in this period, state governments had always had a fair amount of flexibility about how they could execute and spend the money under this program. And in this period, the federal government began to allow policy waivers. They began to allow states to experiment with, well, what if we change the eligibility rules? What if we put in work requirements? What if we put in family caps, which were something that was tried in a number of states? Mm-hmm. And the deal that the federal government made with the states was, within broad limits, we would let you change the law as it was applied in your state. But in order to do that, part of the deal was you had to run a randomized experiment. You had to take a random sample of people who you wanted to put on this program, put them on the program, and a random sample of people and not put them on the change program, and execute that according to defined protocols that the federal government established. Generally, it meant using one of two or three contractors who had a lot of experience doing these experiments.
I see.
And there were a total of 34 experiments cataloged by RAND over this period, of which three were in Canada, so there were 31 experiments like this in the United States. And this was probably the best, imperfect, but probably the best prototype for what I'm trying to describe applying at scale across lots of different policy areas. And it discovered what is one of the greatest policy successes in my lifetime in the United States, which is workfare.
Right.
It basically proved out that workfare and only workfare of the things that were tried could move people.
You better define workfare briefly.
Sure. Workfare is essentially the requirement that after a certain amount of time, in order to receive welfare benefits, you had to go to work.
Right.
It's often called work requirements for welfare.
Right.
And it proved in replicated randomized trials that it could move people from welfare to work. It did not reduce earnings. That is, the earnings from the job basically replaced the welfare payments, roughly speaking, that people would have had. It did not immiserate the recipients. It did not increase the use of Medicare and other programs, et cetera. And that became the basis for reformed welfare, which is now called TANF, T-A-N-F, which is the replacement to AFDC,
right,
which is really built around this concept of welfare to work.
So what you have is something of, with regard to social policy, huge historical significance.
Yes.
A genuine breakthrough in the way the federal government makes policy.
Yes.
Okay. Why did it happen then? What were the special circumstances that permitted this breakthrough to take place?
Well, you see the same pattern occur over and over when experimentation starts to be used in a particular area and create practical benefits. Usually there's an objective political crisis. I described the welfare crisis, which anyone who lived through understands. There was a similar, smaller-scale experimental set of breakthroughs that happened around crime, around the massive explosion of crime in the United States, mm-hmm, from the 1960s to the early 1990s, et cetera. So it usually begins with
an
objective political crisis that creates momentum to overcome this problem of politics resistance we described.
The crisis is so bad the political system actually gets serious about solving
it. Exactly, because the public, right, is serious enough that over a sustained period that they create counter pressure to the I build roads to create jobs for my,
right,
quote unquote, for my supporters. Second, it becomes obvious as people focus on practical results that the standard non-experimental social science, which sounds so complicated and impressive, really doesn't solve the problem. And this opens minds to the idea of trying things. And at a practical, around a kitchen table level, it becomes pretty hard to argue, well, it doesn't seem to be working what we're doing now. These guys seem to be talking gobbledygook. I don't understand. This idea sounds like it might work. Let's just try it. And that becomes the political pressure for experimentation. And usually there is a kind of red-haired stepchild component of the social science debate in that area where people have been trying to do experiments and no one's really been paying attention to them, and they published two journal articles in 20 years. And suddenly they are able to break out. They get funded. An agency is set up inside the education department, which is where
so their brains in the picture. They're academics,
that's
professional
exactly
academics.
Right. That's exactly right. Who have been in a subterranean way, almost, developing the idea of experimentation in that area. Suddenly there's funding. Suddenly there's support. And a series of experiments are run, and sometimes it finds good answers.
Okay, now let me ask you, you talk about institutionalized policy waivers. You say anything from school eligibility rules to medical reimbursement schedules to drug use penalties. Okay. Why not go a step further and just give all of those right back to the states in toto? Get the federal government out of it altogether.
Right. Well, at a certain point, if taxes are being collected nationally and then distributed disproportionately to some states rather than others, the people who are paying those bills are inevitably, and in my view appropriately, going to demand accountability for the spending of that money. So in a spectrum, you could imagine I deliver money that is ultimately taxes into a program called Medicaid, which is operated at a more local level, into a program called welfare, operated at a more local level, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I have very detailed rules around that. I could relax those rules, ultimately have what's called a block grant for a thing called Medicare, a block grant for a thing called welfare, et cetera. Ultimately, I could not even have those block grants, right? I could just send the money to the state. I think that the idea that we are going to, quote unquote, block grant these programs, which is a constant refrain in conservative circles, is a fantasy. Because inevitably, over time, people will say, well, wait, you're taking my money. I'm going to demand that you be accountable to me for how you're spending it. So if we were able to achieve block granting, it would simply represent a moment in time political consensus that will not be sustained over time. And so, in my view, a more sustainable structure is to, at whatever level of specificity we demand accountability and define how that money will be expended, to constantly have a process which allows flexibility and experimentation and change of, this is the list of rules for your Medicare program, but you have the ability to experiment and try changes to it.
So you want to retain overall oversight and control of the purse strings at the federal level, not necessarily because that's best for the country, but because that's the political necessity, that you're making a political judgment there.
That's correct.
All right.
I think that it is not only necessary, but in my view, if you are taking tax money from people and insisting that they send it from place A to place B, it is not only inevitable, but in my view, appropriate that those people demand some accountability for how their money is being spent.
Okay. So that, I could talk you into maybe sending all those responsibilities back to the states, but first I'd have to say we're not even going to collect taxes at the federal level for those responsibilities.
That's right. And one of the things I talk about
that's a conversation for another day.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. All right. So another example from Uncontrolled here. Quote, institutionalize social experimentation. The federal government should establish an agency analogous to the Food and Drug Administration to develop, promulgate, and enforce standards for designing and interpreting social policy randomized experiments. Close quote. Okay. Now, unsophisticated little mind that I have, the moment I hear someone say, another agency like the FDA, my blood begins to run cold. But go ahead and explain yourself fast before my blood seizes up altogether.
Well, as a practical matter, for the rest of my life, the United States federal government and the agencies it funds at a more local level are going to be running lots and lots and lots of programs. We're going to have lots of the social welfare programs. We're going to have retirement programs, whether it's called Social Security or not. We're going to have some kind of medical programs, whether we call it Medicaid or not, et cetera. We're going to be running lots of police departments all over the United States. We're going to be running lots of welfare offices all over the United States. My point is that maybe until we reach a nirvana where that's not going to happen, and I don't think we ever will, it would be really sensible when someone comes up with an idea to say, I think we ought to police differently. I think it would work better if we pay attention to broken windows and disorder. I think it would be better to put more cops in the street, et cetera. It would be pretty sensible to have a process to try that in a few police departments and see whether it works or not. And one of the major points of the book is that simple idea is somewhat complicated to do right, and that it would be useful to have essentially a standard-setting body to be able to say, look, this is how you go try that in a few police departments to see how it works, and that we would actually have the federal government run far better if we had some kind of structured process for running those tests and interpreting them in a standardized way, because I've seen this happen in huge companies over and over.
Ah, okay. So maybe when you run for office, Jim, I'll just volunteer for speechwriting. Because if instead of saying another FDA, you say I want to create an agency, entitled The Agency of Does the Damn Thing Work?
Right.
Then
right.
I'm with you.
Right.
Got it. Okay. Again from Uncontrolled. Deregulate schools. School vouchers and charter lotteries provide good evidence that we probably can gain something by introducing choice, allowing schools to operate outside of many existing collective bargaining agreements. Close quote. Okay. Now, people have been struggling to do this for ages. So what is the value added? You're a former consultant. What's the value added of Jim Manzi's insight here? Have you got a new way to handle the teachers' unions who do oppose this sort of thing? Or what are you saying that we ought to do that Mitch Daniels didn't just accomplish in Indiana, where with great huffing and puffing he managed to get through a voucher program?
Right. Well, what I have to say about school choice probably will satisfy neither side in the debate. Because as I go through the evidence, what I observe is that you can conclude with some caveats I lay out in the book that implementing school choice, which has to include choice for schools that are not governed by collective bargaining agreements,
right,
actually does create some improvement. You can see through randomized...
And that data we already have, right? Or
that's correct, although okay. I would say that's not a totally uncontroversial... The statement I just made is not totally uncontroversial in the academy. And as I go through why I think you should believe this evidence and not that evidence, I think there's a clear picture that you create improvement by allowing parental choice for schools as long as some of those choices involve schools that are not governed under collective bargaining agreements, whether we happen to call those charter schools or private schools. Second point, however, is that improvement's actually quite small, that it works for a subset of the population, basically, typically lower-income minority students, and it's only been proven in areas where you have enough population density that choices are realistic among schools. If I'm out in the country and I only have one school, it doesn't really work right.
Right.
So what I say is that this is neither a bad idea, it's a good idea, nor is it nirvana. And it is probably the first step on a journey that's going to take a long time. And that the whole debate about charter schools versus voucher schools is kind of a red herring. That if we imagine the case where we say, well, we give vouchers to students, to families, and students can go to any school they want, we're not going to allow you, even if we did it on the first day, very quickly we would stop allowing a family to use that to send their kids to a bomb-making madrasa, right?
Right.
Or to a school that said, we have incentive payments for parents, which happen to be $1 less than the total tuition tax credit, et cetera.
Right, right.
We'd have to set up regulations. And then you'd have to have some enforcement of those regulations. And then you'd have to have some process of adjudication when a parent said, no, wait, you're not letting me send my child to this school, but really it's just as good as this other school. At that point, how different is that than a public school system
right.
in which you allow a lot more flexibility? And so what I'm arguing is we should do it. We shouldn't expect at least the kinds of things we've done thus far to be totally transformative.
The data from charter schools is, broadly speaking, a little disappointing to conservatives, right? It's not, you don't get results that are dramatically better.
Right. So
okay.
it's not disappointing to me in the sense of it's not surprising to me, because one of the central arguments of the book is you can hear all this great talk about program X, Y, or Z. And in fact, you can see regression and other kinds of analyses that prove that some program is incredibly effective. When you actually do the simple test for almost all programs of, well, give it to some people, not to others, almost everything fails. Very, very few programs demonstrate improvement, and those that do typically create small improvements.
You're used to increments. You're a business guy. You're used to increments.
Well, and I argue when you look at public policies, that's exactly what you see.
All right. One more of these specific proposals that you make in Uncontrolled, Jim. Quote, treat immigration as recruiting. Since the 1970s, we've chosen a strategy that provides low-wage gardeners and nannies for the elite and fierce wage competition for the working class. In other words, it could hardly be worse. Instead, we should think of immigration as an opportunity to improve our stock of human capital. Close quote. And then you go on to write about a simple way to test this concept. So how do you use the notion of experimentation and randomized trials on the problem of immigration?
Well, the starting premise is that it's going to be very important for us to improve our human capital any way we can over the next several decades in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems crazy to me that we don't do what Australia and Canada and Great Britain do, which is say, well, if we're going to we're going to have ex-immigrant, legal immigrants in the United States this year. Let's do our best to make sure they're the best ex-people we can possibly have move to the United States who serve the interests of the citizens of the United States. And one of the things I say is, this sounds great, but we have lotteries right now. There are randomized selection of who gets from certain countries the right to move to the United States. It's very simple, as we did in school choice lotteries, it's very simple to use that to randomize to, well, for a subset of the people who are randomly selected from country X to be allowed to move to the United States, we'll use these criteria which we think might select people who are going to be less likely to be criminal and be more likely to create economic value and so on in the United States, and then track what happens. And randomly select others who are selected under the current method. And it would be imperfect, but we'd be able to see, well, if we apply these rules to selecting immigrants over the next 5 years, what are the rates of criminality? What are the rates of, you know, business formation, et cetera? To me, that seems like a very common sense thing to do.
All right. New segment here. The trial and error tradition of liberty from Uncontrolled, quote, "We need freedom because we are ignorant." Explain yourself.
Well, there's an Anglo-American tradition that begins, you can start these intellectual traditions anywhere, but it becomes clear for sure at the time of Locke and Milton and the English Civil War, through Adam Smith, through in the 20th century, Hayek and Popper and the libertarian philosophers and economists of that era, basically arguing that the reason we need markets or more broadly democratic capitalism, experiments in living, freedom for people to live different ways in different places is in part very practical. There's a very kind of philosophical and moral argument for it, but there's a very practical argument for it, which is we don't really know the way the economy is going to evolve. We don't know what kind of education is going to actually prepare students today for the world 40 years from now and so on. And that by allowing lots of different people to do different things, by having lots of variation and seeing what survives and what thrives, we actually make faster progress than if we try and plan it. And this book is very much in that tradition.
So it's freedom as a process of discovery. Now, there is a process, freedom to discover information, randomized field trials, experiment. All this sounds, you're comfortable in the world of technique and data. So all this sounds to me more Brookings than Manhattan Institute. And yet you're a fellow at the Manhattan Institute. It sounds more Science Today and or peer-reviewed journals than National Review. And yet you're a member of the board of National Review. So here you are. There are moments in this book where you say, well, this is all very persuasive, but this sounds like cutting edge in France. This is a sort of technocratic almost. And yet here's Jim Manzi, who when it comes time to choose where he wants to be a fellow and where he wants to donate some money and time by sitting on a board, he chooses conservative and libertarian operations. How come?
Well, there are several reasons probably. First of all, I don't think of this as a partisan book. I really do not think of this as sitting on the left side or the right side in the current political debate in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I did not try to weigh into partisan politics in the book at all. I believe that I tried to work forward from what I thought was right and simply lay out what I thought was the right thing to do, and kind of the chips fell where the chips fell in terms of where some policies fall on the current political spectrum versus others. I believe, however, that the current conservative movement, for lack of a better term, in the United States probably could use a dose of more empiricism, would probably do better, make more progress, create better proposals if it took all the great things that it has and had a mixture of more empiricism.
So you're thrilled that the GOP nominee is Mitt Romney, whose favorite phrase is data bath.
Right.
So the one time I heard him speak, I heard him say that he used to love as a consultant to take a bath in the data.
Right.
You and he would be soul brothers.
Well,
I'm making a serious point here. This is a guy who is fundamentally conservative, and yet he's wide open to data, experimentation, finding out what works, right?
I supported Mitt Romney in the Republican primaries.
You did? Okay. All right. So a couple of final questions now. You say in Uncontrolled, again, with data, experimentation, and yet here's this sentence from Uncontrolled, quote, "We will never eliminate the need for strategy and some kind of long-term vision." Okay, now explain to me why that doesn't tend to undermine everything you've written before.
It does.
It does?
Yeah. So what I'm...
An honest man.
Yeah,
all right.
The point I was trying to make, one of the major points I was trying to make in this book, and I lay out the what you described in the introduction to the book,
right,
is once you accept the power of trial and error, of various kinds of trial and error, and I spent a lot of time on this in the book, I begin the last section of the book by saying the natural conclusion is just let it rip. You know, just start to allow maximum amount of trials and experimentation and so on. And I say, look, why isn't that true? You know, what are the limits to this? What determines how far is too far? And a simple way to describe how far is too far is we live in a society. And at a certain point, it becomes repugnant to people to live in a political society with others who live so radically differently than they do, who have such a radically different vision of the good life, who behave in ways that we don't want to countenance. Further, a totally unstructured, deregulated economy creates all kinds of social problems and lack of social consent for a market, et cetera. And I'm speaking in rough terms, obviously, and I spent a lot more time in the book on this. But what I try and do in the whole last section of the book is essentially say, I've made the argument to do X. Now let me try and define X by finding its limits, by saying, how far should we let X go before we start reaching a limiting principle? And it's the balance between this idea of trial and error progress and the need for coherence and the need for vision that establish its boundaries.
When it comes down to it, you're with Edmund Burke, not with Ron Paul.
Correct. That's exactly
right. When it comes down, exactly experimentation, right, but you want it all rooted in society as we live.
What I say is the social vessel must survive for experimentation to happen within it.
Okay. Now, truly final questions. So on the one hand, trial and error, hard data. On the other hand, vision. Give me your one or two sentences of advice for Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. What would you say to Barack Obama first?
Well, I think that depoliticizing as much as possible the economy would be probably the best advice I could give to him. We partially in response to a massive crisis inserted the political process to a substantially greater degree than it had been true historically during the period of early 2009 into 2010.
$800 million stimulus package, for example.
Yeah,
the stimulus package.
The United States government at a certain point was the majority shareholder of the largest car company, the largest bank, the largest insurance company, and the largest, second largest brokerage in the United States. We are unwinding some of those positions. We are stepping in certain areas. The government is being pretty smart about getting back out of those, but it's further and further penetrated into the healthcare economy. It's further and further penetrated into lots of areas of the economy. So I think, quote unquote, depoliticizing as much of the economy as possible.
Depoliticizing means pulling the government back.
That's right. I think would be the sink. If you asked me one piece of advice to get to Barack Obama, that would be it.
Okay. And for Mitt Romney?
Well, I think that, we talked about this idea of the tension between data-driven trial and error process and strategy and vision.
And he's got one but not the other?
Exactly.
I mean, that's what I would
feel. I think he is laying out a clearer vision for where we're trying to go with all this data and analysis and process he talks about would probably be a smart thing to do. And I'm not alone, I'm sure, in giving him that advice.
Jim Manzi, author of Uncontrolled. First of all, fellow at the Manhattan Institute, which publishes the City Journal, which has a regular feature on California. I thank you for your participation in the Manhattan Institute. To the many tens of thousands of conservatives who cut their teeth on National Review and enjoy it, I thank you for your membership on the board of National Review. And Jim Manzi, author of Uncontrolled, The Surprising Payoff of Trial and Error for Business, Politics, and Society. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now a few minutes of Jonah Goldberg. This comes from an interview we recorded earlier before Jonah's new book came out, so it didn't do any good then. But now the book is out. Jonah Goldberg on The Tyranny of Clichés, How Liberals Cheat in the War of Ideas. If I may, I will quote from a certain book that's going to be published this spring,
uh-huh,
The Tyranny of Clichés. But this is not a book interview. The book isn't out yet. Bill Clinton and his advisors mastered the art of using the term middle class to win elections for a party that was obsessed with categorizing people in terms that negate the very idea of a middle class. Explain yourself.
Well, first of all, middle class is one of these brilliant sort of dog whistle terms, starting with Bill Clinton. I mean, maybe it goes back further than that, but that's where I pick up the story. Because when Bill Clinton got elected talking about people working hard and playing by the rules and middle class values and all of the rest, so it allowed him to talk about social issues in a way that sounded like they were economic issues, and allowed him to talk about economic issues sometimes as a way that sounded like social issues. And everybody heard what they wanted to hear. And one of the weird ironies is that, you know, somewhere close to 90% of the American people call themselves middle class. You know, Mitt Romney's gotten himself in trouble for forgetting this from time to time. And so the problem is that the reason, the way Bill Clinton and Democratic politics and liberal politics policies undermine the very idea of the middle class is, if you talk about the middle class in terms of the bourgeoisie, in terms of the burghers, the men and women who work hard intrepidly with old-fashioned values and all of the rest, the Babbitts, as you will. Those kinds of values of thrift and savings and hard work and all of the rest are undermined by contemporary American liberalism, because the goal of contemporary American liberalism is to turn the people into clients of the state. And that goes back to FDR and the New Deal, is this idea that we should create constituencies among the people that are utterly dependent upon the government. They don't necessarily have to be on the dole, but they have to have the major infrastructure of their lives be delivered by government. And once you do that, you will vote to sustain or expand those things that you get from government. And over time, that erodes the very values that create a middle class in the first place.
Have you read Charles Murray's book yet, Coming Apart?
I've leafed through a bunch of it. Okay. You know.
So Murray's argument, as I understand, I haven't read the book yet.
Yeah.
I will. The top 20% of Americans, those who send their kids to private schools in Washington, continue to exhibit the virtues of hard work, religious belief, and traditional marriage, but the bottom 30% have over the last few decades ceased to do so. I now quote our friend David Brooks in his review of the book, Coming Apart, in the New York Times, quote, the word class doesn't even capture the divide that Charles Murray describes. You might say the country has bifurcated into different social tribes. Close quote. Is the middle class gone?
No, I don't think it's gone. But you were, I mean, what Charles documents, from what I can tell very well, is that basically the whole society was going to hell in a handbasket, right? And it was going into a nosedive, through the 60s into the 70s. And
meaning the top 20% and the bottom 30% and everybody in between was shedding the traditional values
That's
of
right.
hard work and marriage
right.
they and religious.
Were, they,
everybody was throwing it over the
they're
side.
They're bailing out their social capital off of both sides of the ship.
Right.
And as they were going into this nosedive, not to mix the metaphor too much, the top quintile, however you want to put it, realized what a disaster this was and pulled up.
Some people wised up.
Yeah.
In time.
And too many other people kept going down. And one of the reasons why, I mean, I don't know if this is Charles' argument, but I think he would agree with this. One of the reasons why is simply that the wealthier you are, the more you can afford to learn from your mistakes. And, this is one of the things that always, drives me crazy about Madonna. You know, Madonna is one of these characters from my youth. In the 1980s, she was this huge symbol, you know, pop icon beyond belief, the Elvis of the 1980s in some ways. And she glorified, she represented what I would call slattern chic, right? This idea that you can just, if it feels good, do it, and all this kind of stuff. And of course, she learned from her mistakes, and then she became this family woman and and this super mom, according to People magazine and all those kinds of magazines. And she could afford to do that because she had tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars.
She has nannies to take care of the children.
Her nannies have nannies. Right. I mean, she has entourages of people. She once told in an interview that she doesn't have any problems changing diapers because she's never changed a diaper. The problem is that the people in the lower and middle lower classes who followed her example, if they made one mistake, if they had a baby out of wedlock, or if they just went, too far or whatever, they didn't have the resources to rebound from those kinds of mistakes. And I think that that's one of the things that we are seeing, is that we're seeing a sort of unraveling. It's very difficult if you don't have the resources emotional and otherwise, and financial, it's very hard to pull out of that nosedive. And you know, Irving Kristol always used to say that there was nothing wrong with this country that a good recession wouldn't fix. And I'm beginning to think he was wrong, because we've been in a pretty good recession, and you haven't seen a sort of hunkering down and reacquainting of the people with these sort of traditional sort of bourgeois values that you might vote.
You don't think the Tea Party represents some sense? Go ahead.
I do. I think the Tea Party is a very healthy thing. I mean, I've been saying for a long time now that the Tea Parties are essentially sort of a stem cell therapy response. Extremely healthy. They help the Republican Party regrow a spine, and that was a very good thing. And I think at the same time, you look at the Tea Parties. I've spoken to a lot of Tea Party rallies and whatnot, and you look at the Tea Parties, and they're older, they're more established.
They're the top 20%?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think you make
a good
point.
They're the 50% in the middle.
Who can see
their kids going either down or up, or
yeah. But I mean, then you I think the Tea Partiers are probably smarter than the Occupy Wall Street guys. But I would bet you that the Occupy Wall Street guys are far better credentialed in terms of their education, and the Occupy Wall Street people think that, you know, the Constitution needs to be rewritten so that they have a right to an iPod.
Okay. Two clips. You tell me which of these two has a better feeling for what's actually happening in the middle class in America and for what needs to be done.
Okay. This is the defining issue of our time. This is a make or break moment for the middle class and for all those who are fighting to get into the middle class.
I'm in this race because I care about Americans. I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs repair, I'll fix it. I'm not concerned about the very rich. They're doing just fine. I'm concerned about the very heart of America, the 90-95% of Americans who right now are struggling, and I'll continue to take that message across the nation.
Well, obviously, look, I'm a conservative, and therefore I'm more in favor of the Republican Party than the Democratic Party, which is not to say that I define myself as a Republican. I define myself as a conservative. But so I would think that Mitt Romney has better instincts about this, or better policies about this.
But on the evidence of that clip?
On the evidence, that's why I'm being coy here. I think on the evidence of that clip, Mitt Romney is just an incredibly frustrating politician.
Fine. We'll let it go at that. My thanks to Jonah Goldberg, author of The Tyranny of Clichés, How Liberals Cheat in the War of Ideas. And my thanks to Jim Manzi, author of Uncontrolled, The Surprising Payoff of Trial and Error for Business, Politics, and Society. For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.